Welcome to Mysterious Topics, a podcast focusing on intriguing topics deserving further scrutiny. Each episode, the hosts examine a topic, add their opinions, and hopefully pique your interest as well. Visit MysteriousTopics.com for contact information and more. Now, here are your hosts, Chuck and John.
Hi, John.
So, you remember back when we were kids, and that was quite a bit before the internet. As a matter of fact, we had our phone lines. We even had party lines. Do you remember that?
Oh, definitely. Yes, we could listen to other people's conversations, and of course, they could listen to ours. And you could always tell when they were on there listening because you could hear some clicking.
Yeah,
those were the days.
I bet you a lot of young people today would probably be amazed by that. That if you want to make a phone call, you'd pick up the phone and you'd hear somebody else's conversation and hang it back up and try back 5 minutes later, and they were still there. So
you know, probably. Yeah, probably many people listening to this have no idea what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
But we actually did have that kind of a phone system, believe
yes,
it or not.
For a short time anyway. But well, at least for me, it was a short time. It wasn't too much. I was just a little kid, and then we didn't have that. But I do remember it a little bit. But anyway, because of that, when we were kids, we didn't have a lot of entertainment inside, so we were always outside. And we would, as kids, you'd be going around the neighborhood with other kids, and you'd start digging holes and everything, and, you know, just pretty much outside the whole time. And when I was in about fourth grade in school, I read this story in my weekly reader about the Oak Island mystery. And I've really, I've been following it and fascinated by it ever since, because it's so inexplicable, as we will get into.
Yes, I had heard about Oak Island many years ago, but I had nowhere near the fascination for it that you have had. I mean, this is like many years now that you've been kind of thinking about this, not every day, of course, but you've thought about it over the years. And so I'm sure your curiosity is pretty high in this topic.
Yeah, like I said, as like a fourth grader when I first read it, every time I've seen it come up in the news, I would be following it. So, so that's where we are now. So back in 1795 is when the story really began, when a person by the name of Daniel McGinnis. Now, he's been called anywhere from 13 to 18 years old at the time, so I'm not exactly sure, but he was the first one to go out to Oak Island, which was about 500 yards off the shore of Nova Scotia. It's a little island about a half mile wide and about a mile long, right around that area somewhere. He went out there because he thought he had seen some strange lights, possibly, so he wanted to go check it out, and he did, and he was walking through the island. He found a area that looked circular, and it looked depressed, like something was dug there, and then it naturally sunk down a little bit, and above it was a big tree branch, and there were reports that said there was a block and tackle hanging in the tree, and other reports said there wasn't a block and tackle. That's kind of in dispute, but whatever, he had found some sort of evidence that he thought something might be buried there. And so he started digging. Well, he didn't have anything with him, I'm sure. I'm just guessing, but I'm pretty sure he wasn't planning on digging when he went out by himself, and probably he was trying to dig with his hands or something, and decided not to do that anymore, and he went back home and came out the next day with a couple of his friends. And friends' names were John Smith and Anthony Vaughn, and the three of them came prepared to dig and see what they could find. So they started digging, and they found a couple feet below the surface, they found a layer of what they called flagstones. I guess they were flat stones that were laid down around the pit, and I believe the pit was about 7 to 9 feet in diameter, roughly. And then they kept digging, and they got down to 10 feet, where they ran into a layer of oak logs laid across and going into the dirt on either side. So they managed to somehow get these logs. These three guys, they must have been working pretty hard. I know I dug a hole recently for my basketball goal and my 11-year-old son, and I dug a 2-foot by 2-foot hole. We had to go down 4 feet to get below the frost line, and that was a chore in itself. So they've already made it down to 10 feet and then got these
logs.
And
they obviously didn't have any. They didn't have any special equipment or anything. They just had probably crude shovels, just like maybe you did when you were.
Yeah.
You probably had a fancy shovel, but they had crude shovels.
Yes, I'm sure they did. But and nowhere does it really say what kind of equipment they had. But as you'll find out as we go here this day, they must have had some rope, maybe some sort of a ladder. And like you said, obviously they each had a shovel or something that they could use as a shovel. So they got down to this 10-foot level. They got the logs out. They started digging again, and they got down 20 feet, and they found another row of logs. So I don't know how long this was supposedly the first day. I'm just thinking, I just can't imagine that they got down 20 feet that fast, but at any rate.
No, I can't believe they would have. No, I can't believe that they went that quickly.
Yeah, this must have been over a period of days or possibly weeks, but.
I would think so. I could see them waking up in the morning and saying, okay, let's get back out to the island and start digging again, but not all in one day.
Yeah, because they
I'm
were
sure
probably.
They were excited because. You know,
yes.
They were finding some interesting stuff.
And there were rumors back at that time about the pirates only maybe within the last 100 years had ventured up in that area, and not far from that area. So that's why they were probably excited. So they got back out there. After the 20-foot layer with the logs, they kept digging underneath that, and they got all the way down to 30 feet. And guess what they found there? Some more logs. So now they've had a.
Hubby had to be thinking, what's going on here, huh?
Yes, and this is the third layer, and they're all at 10-foot intervals. So that was obviously, now you're down 30 feet, and like I said, they must have had rope or something, and they must have kept one of them up there to fish the other guys out. They must have been taking turns, but they were getting to the point where, okay, this is a little too deep. They just can't do it. So they had to scratch their plans and go back and try to reassess how they're gonna go about getting this. And they didn't go back until 8 years later, when they convinced the Onslow Company, which was formed for the purpose of the search, and it was a relative of, I believe. I think it was Anthony Vaughn. It was one of his it was like an uncle or something that was behind this Onslow Company. And they put together, and they've been talking about it for 8 years. They must have thought they were onto something. So they got this company together, and they got out there with a bunch of people, and they quickly got back down to the 30-foot level from 8 years ago. It obviously got filled up over the 8 years to a certain point anyway. And then they continued digging. They found the same thing. They found a layer of oak logs at every 10-foot interval. besides the boards, they got at around at 40 feet was a layer of charcoal, and then after that, there was a layer of putty at around 50 feet, and then down around 60 feet, they found a layer of coconut fiber. But one of the biggest finds was when they got all the way down to the 90-foot level, and just below that, I believe it was at 93 feet, they found this stone with kind of a mysterious hieroglyphic writing on it. And the stone was purported to be anywhere from 175 to 500 pounds. So either way, that was a heavy, heavy stone. After they got the stone out and they started digging again, water began to seep into the pit. And within a day, the water had filled all the way up to the 33-foot level. So there was over 60 feet of water in there. So they tried to pump it within the next year, I think. They were trying to pump it. They couldn't really do it. So what they did was they went out there the next year and dug a parallel pit to the original one all the way down to 100 feet. So they started all over with a brand new spot and dug all the way down to 100 feet. And from there, they tunneled over to the money pit. But when they got close to the money pit, the water flooded in, and they just kind of gave up for a long time.
That's right. And just a few more notes about Oak Island. First of all, Oak Island is in Mahoney Bay, and there are approximately 360 islands in total in Mahoney Bay. So Oak Island wasn't just a single island sitting out in that bay. There were, like I said, many, many islands. And if you look at the island, Oak Island, from above, to me, it looks a little bit like a baby duck. Maybe someone else looking at it thinks it looks like something else, but to me, it looks like a baby duck. But I think it's kind of cute.
Yeah, I've heard other people say that it looks like a peanut, but I like the baby duck a lot better. Number one, because it's sitting in the water. It's like one of those little yellow rubber duckies just floating around.
It belongs but, there.
And if you look at it and you imagine the rubber duck, the money pit would almost be, it's at the very end of the beak, where the beak would begin, I should say, not at the end, but where the beak almost close to where the eyeball of the duck would be.
Yes, it almost looks like the eye of the duck.
Yes.
You know, the location of the pit. Right. And another intriguing thing about the island, it's about 140 acres, so it's not especially big. And it's 200 miles as the crow flies east of Bangor, Maine. That gives kind of a reference to where it is in relation to the United States. So it's really not that far from the United States. And also, I'm a little bit intrigued by when you first started talking about this, John, you mentioned Daniel McGinnis thought he had seen some lights. What were these lights? How did these lights get out there? Who was out there with lights? I mean, was this just in his imagination, or was it just a mirage, or was actually somebody out there doing something with the pit? You know, somebody before Daniel McGinnis, you know, right in that same time period. So that just kind of intrigued me a little bit. And what else? Does anything else kind of stand out with you in this?
Well, as far as the lights are concerned, yeah, there. I think what I heard about that was, not just he, I think other people have saw lights at various times, not just once. So, and I don't know, you know, people could say, well, it's some kind of weird thing, or it could have just been if whoever was burying whatever they were burying out there, could, if they back then they would have obviously only had candle or flames of some sort, and they could have, because they said the lights were a strange green color, so that was why it wasn't just somebody walking around with a lantern or something. I don't know what it could have been. They could have had some. They used to have those glass balls that they would use for floats and boats and.
All right.
Back then, yes, yes. And I've seen some of them. I actually had a couple small ones, and they're kind of that green glass color. So I'm just wondering if they would have had something like that they might have put over a torch or a candle or something to keep it from blowing out. Somebody, I don't know. I'm just completely guessing at that. But the other thing I wanted to mention about following your baby duck description, right at the throat of the duck, is a swamp area that is shaped almost like a perfect triangle, and that's just kind of something interesting to keep in mind for when we go further on in the story.
Yes, another note, just to put this in a time frame, George Washington was president at this time when this whole discovery began in 1795. So that kind of, it's our first president, United States, first president of the United States. So it's a long time ago. And I think that pretty much kind of summarizes the first initial discovery. This is the interesting part. Three young boys just out there. Another thing, John, how do you think they got onto the island? The island is about 500 feet away from the mainland. Did they have a boat what do you think?
Yeah, 500 yards or 500 feet, I think. But yeah, regardless, I'm sure they had a boat.
Or a raft or something.
Yes, so I'm sure they weren't swimming out there.
No, that's the ocean, so that's,
yeah,
they could have, I guess, but okay. Well, as it turns out, the Onslow Company, by the way, the Onslow Company, they were located originally near True in central Nova Scotia, and they, with the boys, they sailed 300 nautical miles, that's quite a distance, from central Nova Scotia to Oak Island. So it wasn't just like a hop, skip, and a jump. They had to go a little ways to get over there. But somehow the boys must have known somebody, and then they convinced them to do it. But anyway, the Onslow Company, they had inadvertently unplugged a 500-foot waterway. And as quickly as that water could be pumped out, it was refilled again by the sea. It turns out that it was kind of like a booby trap. And so obviously there was some kind of a ingenious plan by whoever designed this area around the pit, that it wasn't going to be easy for some treasure seekers to get at it. There was going to be some difficulty. If anybody wanted to do this, apparently it wasn't going to be easy. And I noticed when you earlier were talking, John, you mentioned the charcoal and the putty and the coconut fiber. And the coconut fiber especially wouldn't be available naturally on the island. So it had to come from, not even in that area, coconut fiber. So it had to come from a long distance away. And I think you might have some, I was thinking maybe they could have, the coconuts could have floated up along with the Gulf Stream. But I think you had some interesting thoughts about where that coconut fiber might have come from.
Yeah, it was just apparently, and this makes perfect sense when you think about it, that people back in the 17th, 18th centuries were using coconut fiber as a packing material. So anytime they would send whatever their supplies that were possibly breakable, or they just wanted to protect from getting tossed around in the rough seas, they would pack it with, they would use coconut fiber as a, it's kind of like the peanuts, the packing peanuts that we have today to keep things from breaking. So, so that's how it got there. That's probably not a surprise. The only thing is that it was obviously put there by someone. It didn't just naturally end up down, 60 feet down a hole in one big clump all by itself. I mean, it was purposely, there was a layer of charcoal at 40 feet, a layer of putty at 50 feet, and a layer of coconut fiber at 60 feet. So it was put there by someone purposely.
And so the searchers that had found these items, you know, it definitely would have made it very intriguing and encouraged them. Finding these things would have encouraged them to keep going, because the prospect of something valuable or interesting down there is very likely. And a little while later, after the Onslow Company had been there, the Truro Company, and that's actually where the Truro Company is named after the city or village that the Onslow Company came from. But they started doing something which I think is quite smart. They started drilling core samples. And core samples are used today by explorers, you know, oil explorers or any kind of a natural resource explorer, you know, natural gas or minerals of some kind. Drilling with core samples rather than just starting to dig and haphazardly trying to find something. So that made a lot of sense that they were doing this back in 1849. Well, this is actually 49. This is 54 years after the original discovery. So we're moving along pretty good. But these core samples, they produced some interesting results, didn't they, John?
Yes, that's really when they started to get encouraged, because they drilled down to around the 90-foot level, and they went through what they determined was some sort of a spruce platform or boards or logs or something, and then a little further down they went through some oak. And then they went through a gap of somewhere around 20, 22 inches, characterized as some sort of metal or metal pieces or something like that. I don't know what kind of metal it wasn't. If it would have been gold or silver, I'm sure they would have said gold or silver. So I'm guessing it was more of an iron or something. But then after that, they went through 8 inches of oak and some more metal after that. And then they continued to go down. They went through some more oak and some more spruce. And what they had decided, what they thought anyway, as they're doing this, they thought, you know, we could be drilling through casks or chests or something, possibly filled with coins or some kind of metal.
That's what I would have been thinking.
Yes, so they've gone through wood and metal, and but I'm not exactly sure how big of a drilling core they're making, but you would think even if it was kind of twisting up the metal, you'd be able to see that it was a real coin, even though it would have been beaten up by the drill. So they, and there was no report that they said definitely it was coins, but
just finding that metal down there at 98 feet, I mean, that would really be, to me, pretty exciting if you're interested in looking for a treasure, because, you know, in my mind, I would be thinking, what else would this be way down there? You know, what could it be? It had to be something pretty cool.
Yes, I would think they'd be able to tell the difference between just like a raw chunk of iron ore, as opposed to some other type of metal that somebody had made, or gold or silver or something.
Yeah, right.
But then, and there was an account of when they brought up the drill bit that there were three small gold links that might have been from some sort of a gold chain or something. And I did see people speculate that it possibly might have been somebody that was down there that had a gold watch or something, you know, so there was a dead body, in other words, like maybe that they were, people thought possibly it was a burial site, maybe, but I don't know who would go to the trouble of burying somebody 98 feet below.
I don't think you have to go that far.
Yeah. Well, if it was somebody you didn't want anybody else to find, I guess, but.
I guess so.
So then they kept drilling down there, and they determined that below the last layer of spruce, the ground was very loose, which they kind of thought, well, what that must mean is it must go a lot deeper. So the Truro Company returned then now in 1850. So this is 55 years into the since the original discovery by Daniel McGinnis. They decided to go back then and dig another parallel hole and then tunnel over to the Money Pit, just like they had tried before. And just like they had tried before, water began to rush in again, and they were prepared for it. They brought in pumps and were pumping the water out, but their pumps just could not keep up with the water. It was rushing in as fast as they were pumping it out. So, but then, at this particular time, somebody just happened to notice while they were pumping frantically water out, somebody was over at Smith's Cove, and they noticed during low tide that there was water coming out of the beach. Then they thought, what is going on here? And they made this startling discovery.
I can just imagine standing there by the beach, and all of a sudden water starts coming out. I'm thinking, what in the world is going on here? Why is water coming out of here?
It's like somebody pulled the plug in it.
Yeah, that don't make sense. But what it indicated and what they discovered was this was not a natural beach. This beach was artificial. And it was apparently quite an intriguing and elaborate artificial beach. It was an ingenious method where they used beach rocks covered with inches of eelgrass and then more inches of coconut fiber. And it had a really effective filtering system that allowed the channels to remain clear of silt and sand, and yet the water was still allowed to flow along. And it really was well laid out, and it showed that somebody had been doing something here. But now the Truro Company thought, well, this is going to make it pretty simple. All we got to do is block off the water and dig out our treasure to block it off from the beach. And they thought, well, we could build a dam just off the beach at Smith Cove, and then they drain the water and dismantle the drain channels. But then a storm blew up and the dam was destroyed. Now, I would have thought they would have tried again to build another dam. But another finding that was made was an earlier, older dam was found when they were building the new one. So somebody else had tried to do this before. I don't know. Who knows how long ago it was. But somebody else had been doing this. But anyway, this was the last attempt by the Truro Company on Oak Island.
Okay, so the next attempt at the treasure was made by the Oak Island Association, and this was in 1861, which was the same year Abraham Lincoln became president of the United States. So we've now covered a span from George Washington all the way up to Abraham Lincoln. They first they got the money pit cleared out down to 88 feet, and then they tried a new hole to the east of the pit, hoping to find that channel that ran from the cove that was flooding it. So they dug this shaft to try to find that flood channel down to 120 feet without hitting the channel. And then apparently they gave up on that. You think they would have maybe tried to tunnel a little bit over to the sides or try another hole, but anyway, then they did run another hole down to 118 feet to the west. And from this hole, they tried what everybody else had tried before. They tried tunneling over to the money pit. And they thought it was going to work. And they had water started to enter the pit just like it had everywhere else, but they were bailing it out, and it appeared like they were keeping up with it. And then all of a sudden, when they were down there, the bottom of this tunnel fell out and water rushed into the shafts, and then the bottom of the money pit dropped over 15 feet. So just imagine that the money pit had already been dug down to about the 90-foot level, and as they tunneled over to it, with the water coming into that tunnel as well as the other one, the bottom of the money pit just dropped 15 feet. So over the next several years, they kept trying to figure out what's going on, and they tried digging more shafts. They tried to fill in the drain that was out on the beach that they had found, but they tried building a new dam, and it got destroyed the same way by a storm again. every time they'd attempt something, it was almost like Mother Nature or something was watching out for this treasure, because something always happened to foil their attempts. But they even tried drilling for more core samples, and they just didn't have any success.
And again, there you had the problem with water rushing in. That seems to be a constant problem. And apparently that area must have been a prime area for storms, because it seems like we're always talking about a storm interrupting. And not only that one storm or two storms, but there must have been so many difficulties with storms and other situations that caused them to stop the search, because apparently for another, I believe, 32 years, they didn't go back. So it wasn't now until 1893, which is almost 200 years after Daniel McGinnis first saw the lights on Oak Island. And now there's a new company, the Oak Island Treasure Company. They began their search. Now, they wanted to check out this cave-in pit that John was just talking about a few minutes ago. And they dug 350 feet, I believe, east of the money pit. And there apparently was a shaft dug out by the designers, kind of maybe as a ventilation shaft. So there would be, kind of fresh air or something to that extent that would make it easier to dig when they're way down deep in the pits. Well, anyway, while it was being cleared by the Treasure Company, it started to flood again at 55 feet, and again, it was abandoned. So, and over the next several years, the Oak Island Treasure Company, they dug more shafts, they pumped more water, and they didn't get anywhere. Then they did manage to finally clear the money pit down to 111 feet, but they saw the entrance to the flood tunnel, which was temporarily stopped up with rocks. But the water, again, as usual, worked its way in. Now they thought, well, let's seal off the flow from Smith's Coast, cut the water off. But how were they going to do that? Well, they were going to dynamite it. You know, let's just blow it up and see what happens. Now, my thought, and yours probably too, John, it's probably going to screw up or make the treasure a little bit less valuable because dynamite isn't very selective in what it blows apart. So,
yeah, I'd be concerned with. I can see their frustration level. It's been, and they've known about the other people all these years and to no success, and they just say, what the heck, let's try to blow it up. But but then would you feel safe going down over 100 feet down at a place that just dynamite went off?
No, I wouldn't. A couple days before,
and who, yeah.
Probably the leader of the expedition would say, okay, he'd pick out a few of the lowly workers and say, you guys go down and check it out.
yeah.
I don't think I would be the one.
Yeah, I get freaked out by the thought of crawling, 100 feet underground. And that'd be my constant worry is when is this going to cave in and I'm just buried alive down here.
So you would never want to be a miner, I take it.
No, I've been in mines, and I think they're really cool to go visit. But the whole time I'm in there, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, man, if there was an earthquake now, and it just kind of closed off the entrance, then yeah, that would be a nightmare.
Yeah, especially if the entrance got closed off, yet you were still alive with enough oxygen in there, and you know you're stuck, and that's where you're going to die.
Yeah.
That would not be a pleasant thought.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't. So at that point, like you said, they were attempting some new core sample drilling, and they started to discover some more interesting things when they drilled down to. It was around 125, 126 feet, something like that. Wood, they hit wood, and then some iron. And then they thought, well, maybe that iron was some of the material that fell when the cave-in of the pit. There was, guys up the top. I imagine some stuff fell in when that happened. So they kept drilling, and there was some more wood encountered, and then they kind of discovered that the iron was kind of probably laying in a pattern that it would have fallen in. It was kind of some was here and some then they didn't hit some. So, but anyway, they kept drilling down. They got between 130 and 150 feet. And then also between 160 and 170 feet, there was a blue clay was found, which was apparently made up of clay, sand, and obviously water. But this clay and clay in general is found under lakes and streams and oceans and that, and it does make a watertight seal. So this clay was put down there by somebody, and they probably knew that it would. That's why it was there, because they knew it would form a watertight seal. And they said it was probably the same putty that was found years ago at the 50-foot level. And I believe somewhere along the line it read where when they were digging in the bay, in the cove, where the fingered water traps were that went down into the water trap that went down into the tunnel, when they dug that out originally, though, that was at the bottom of a possibly swampy area, and that's probably where they got all this putty when they dug
when they dug down the holes to go down to the money pit. So they found between the putty layers, they found what they determined to be a cement vault. The vault was around 7 feet high with 7-inch thick walls. Inside the vault, the drill hit something that some wood, and then there was a void for a while with the drill, and then some sort of unknown substance, and then next a layer of some sort of soft metal was hit, and then almost 3 feet of more metal in pieces apparently, and then some more soft metal after that. But when the drill bit was brought back up, there was something else that they found. Attached to the auger was a small piece of parchment made out of sheepskin, and it was very small, but there was what they determined said the letters were, it was either a V or a U or a W, but it was with an I, so it was W-I, V-I, or U-I, or something like that, on this parchment down there. So that makes it even more intriguing, because now somebody had written something on a piece of parchment that was that far under the ground, along with going through concrete and wood and metal pieces. So that that made the treasure company, you know, more determined than ever, and they began to sink more shafts and trying to get down to that cement vault, but they just couldn't get down there because of all of the flooding.
Right, and that cement vault, especially finding those pieces of metal, including soft metal, inside of it. So if I were looking at this treasure and thinking about it, I would say, well, they've got this cement vault, so it's obviously something they want, whoever put it there wants to protect what's inside of it. And then when you find metal inside, perhaps valuable metal of some kind, gold perhaps, or coins, or something else valuable. And then that sheepskin parchment, that adds even more intrigue to the whole story. And to me, I can see how individuals would be saying, let's keep going. This is something important, and we have to keep searching. And then a few years later, in May of 1899, they found a second flood tunnel. Now this one was at the South Shore Cove, right at the bottom of the island, as you're looking at it from above, looking from south to north. And the designers here had been even more ingenious and had done more work than previously thought. Now, when they found this, it made the case even stronger that something was really neat buried down there. But it didn't bring anybody closer to finding the treasure. And the Oak Island Treasure Company continued to sink new shafts and drill more core samples. But again, no progress was made and no new information obtained. And now we have kind of a lull again. Some attempts were made after this for several years, but nothing valuable was found and no success was made for at least another 30-some years.
Yeah, and that brings us to 1936, when Gilbert Haddon, working along with a guy called Fred Blair, they began a new probe of the island. And Haddon cleared some of the earlier shafts near the pit, and he made plans to do some more exploratory drilling, but he also made a couple discoveries elsewhere on the island. He found a fragment of stone with some sort of inscriptions possibly similar to the ones that were on that inscribed stone that we talked about at the 93-foot level of the money pit, that very big, heavy rock, which, inexplicably, somehow that stone disappeared. It was one of the workers had it in his house as possibly a doorstop or in his fireplace, and then it eventually made it to a museum, a local museum, but then it got lost. And the horrible thing about that is nobody got any kind of a picture, or I know they used to do some kind of rubbing where you could get the inscriptions off of a stone, so you'd have some kind of evidence of what exactly it looked like. They did make a replica and said this is what was on there, but sadly they don't have the original, so we don't know for sure about that. But
and that's intriguing that we don't have the original. I think, and maybe you do too, John, that somebody knew its value. I think somebody knew its value and hid it someplace or put it someplace where only he or she and maybe somebody close to this person would know where it is. And maybe we will never know because perhaps those people have died and not told anybody where it was. Or I guess it's possible it could have just been misplaced, but I don't think so. To me, I think the value of it was known at the time, and somebody purposely hid it.
Oh, that could be. I guess we'll never know. Either that, or somebody just it really wasn't that mysterious as far as the because that's the problem. If you don't have the actual some kind of recording of the actual inscriptions, we don't know if they're saying, this replica, if that's in fact what it was or not. So that is an issue here. But anyway, one of the other discovery that Haddon made was he found several old timbers in Smith's Cove. They seem to have been left or made. They're still there from the original designers because of the fact that they were joined using wooden pins instead of metal, so that just kind of would give an indication of the time period as to when this was made. And
yes, that's right.
And so after that, the mystery just keeps to get deeper and deeper.
Right. I wanted to say a few more words here about Gilbert Haddon, who John just mentioned. He was actually experienced in structural steel and engineering. He had owned a company and he sold it and received a nice sum as payment for that company. So he had some financing available to stick into the search on the island. So that kind of probably had some of the most impressive financial investment so far that we've been talking about. And another thing about Gilbert Haddon, he was so intrigued by this whole issue that he went traveled over to England to speak to the author of Captain Kidd and His Skeleton Island, which was written by Harold Tom Wilkins. Gilbert Haddon had read that book and it resembled so strongly what he was seeing on Oak Island that he was intrigued enough to go over and to speak with Harold Tom Wilkins, the author. But apparently he found out that the author was not even aware of Oak Island, and it just happened to be a coincidence that his writing in the book Captain Kidd and His Skeleton Island was a coincidence. And another thing that happened before this and kind of at the same time was Franklin Roosevelt and some of his buddies in 1909 went to Oak Island. They were intrigued by this money pit. And to me, that adds credibility to the whole issue that, somebody as important as as Franklin Roosevelt going over there. Not only did he go over there as a young man, he went over there. He thought about going over there and talked about going over there when he was president, but he was prevented from doing so because of his many important duties at the time and when he was president. So that issue, just that he did that, adds a lot of credibility in my mind.
Yeah.
To the search.
Yes, it does. And I just wanted to mention about the Captain Kidd, who was he was born in 1645 and died in 1701, and actually I believe he was executed for piracy. He was a Scottish sailor. And now there are reports that he wasn't really a pirate. He was kind of more of a privateer and not necessarily doing wrong out there. And then there are other reports that he was an all-out pirate. And when he was arrested when he arrived back in Scotland and they put him on trial, he apparently bragged about hiding lots of treasure and that, and kind of made mention to that island that you spoke about, Chuck. And he was in Massachusetts for sure. He had showed up there on several accounts and the New York area. So, I mean, it's possible that he would have gone up there. If you're in that area, he did bury some treasure that they found. And in fact, somebody, I forget who it was, somebody in that area found the treasure. It was on Gardner's Island, which is right around Long Island, apparently. And they had found his treasure. Somehow they knew somebody or whatever, but they found it and he dug it up and sent it back to England so they could use it as evidence against him in his trial.
That's correct. And as John mentioned, after this, the mystery deepened. There was another treasure hunter coming along, Irwin Hamilton. He, in 1938, cleared out some earlier shafts and did some more drilling. And then they made two more discoveries. The first was that they found some rocks and some gravel at 190 feet. And Hamilton said they were foreign and they had to be placed there by somebody. They weren't just naturally occurring. And then after clearing the shaft down to 176 feet, a layer of limestone was found. And then they drilled through this. And what do you think they found after they drilled through this limestone? Underneath the limestone, they found wood. Underneath, below the natural limestone. So that isn't something that's going to just, you know, fall there by itself. It has to be there. And this is pretty deep. We're at 170.
Yeah, 176 feet down.
Underneath the limestone, wood. Okay, that's what they found.
That would be shocking. Unless they dug down into an old mine, which wouldn't be under an island, I wouldn't think.
Yeah.
Why would you find wood?
You know, all along here, we've been in different searches, different searchers, different treasure hunters. They've always seemed to find, or most of them at least, something intriguing and interesting that really compelled them to keep searching, at least to try to search as long as they could until they just had to give up for a lack of energy or a lack of money.
I don't know. It's just mind-boggling how complex this whole thing is. And like you said, now they find wood at 176 feet. That's just crazy. And then so now we get up to the year 1959 when Bob Rustall and his family moved there and started to go to work to get this treasure. His one discovery was at the Smith's Cove Beach. While attempting to stop the drain system, he found a rock that had 1704 inscribed on it. somebody, you know, some people claim it was just left by someone as a prank to get them excited about it, but he really believed that it was from the time of the original construction. So, unfortunately, in 1965, well, he'd been working on this now for 6 years, he was excavating a shaft. Bob passed out due to some sort of poisonous gas in this shaft, and he fell into the water at the bottom. His son Bobby attempted to rescue him, as did two more of the workers that were there, and all four apparently were overcome by the same gas. Possibly it could have been carbon monoxide. I don't know if they say is possibly from a generator. I don't know if they had a generator down in the hole that far or not. Could have been some kind of natural methane gas being released down there, but whatever, it made them pass out and they fell into the water below, and there was nobody else there then to try to save them, and they all passed away.
And this still amazes me today when I think of four people falling in. I can see one, two, maybe even three, but when you get to the fourth one, I guess I can understand it. Your curiosity just to see what's going on. Why are these guys falling in the pit? You're going to run up there, but...
Well, I guess because they probably, if it were carbon monoxide, they wouldn't have smelled it. So they would have thought possibly Bob, the first one that fell in, just somehow lost balance and fell in. So then they all just thought, well, we got to go there and help them right away. Not realize, if they would have realized that that pit at the time was filled with some sort of a gas, poisonous gas, I'm sure they wouldn't have gone down in there, but they just probably felt that they had to rescue their friends.
Yeah, I can understand it. I think four people all at once, it just, you know, it's really sad. And at this point, six people have died in the search over the years. And with this four that just John was just talking about, it makes six in all. And apparently the theory of the generator does make sense. Or perhaps some other kind of gas, but probably earlier, in their earlier searches, they weren't using generators because they probably didn't have them years ago. But in 1965, they obviously would have. And that would have probably made their job a little easier, but it also perhaps contributed to the tragedy. And then later on, Bob Dunfield, in 1965 yet, he was the next guy to take on the island. Now, he brought in some heavy machines. Now, I would have thought this is what is going to solve the problem. Once you get some bulldozers and cranes out there and start to block off the water from Smith's Cove, you're going to, you know, kind of meet with some good success, because this isn't just some humans digging and sending down some tunnels or some little search holes. This is some big time heavy machinery stuff, and hopefully by doing this they were going to find something. The drilling by Dunfield was a key to some of their findings. It was determined that at 140 feet there was a 2 foot thick layer of limestone, and then a 40-foot void after that, so down to 180 feet. And at the bottom of this void was bedrock. Now, this kind of matched with what the drilling that had been done 10 years ago in 1955. There seemed to be a large natural underground cavern, which was something apparently common with limestone, and I'm sure this whole area was loaded with limestone on Nova Scotia, on Oak Island, and points to the west, and over covered a large area in limestone, and the underground caverns associated with it apparently are very common.
Right. Isn't that right around where the Niagara Escarpment begins?
Yes.
And
yes.
It runs all the way to Wisconsin.
That's correct.
which is a state we're familiar with, and there is a lot of limestone here, and that does happen. The water, over time, can wash away the limestone and create these types of voids, and most of the time the voids are filled with water constantly running through after it rains and that, I forgot what I was going to say, Chuck.
Well, just going back to those caves or caverns, like you mentioned here in Wisconsin, I know there are many caverns and caves, and I know that's someplace that you're not planning on crawling into anytime soon, but
no.
I know that they're here, and if they're here, I'm sure they were in the Oak Island area, which is similar geologically speaking.
Yes, and what I was going to say, what I forgot, when I just lost my train of thought there, was that that's where these a lot of these sinkholes are formed because of that. I know there's been some recently in Florida is a big spot, but also Nova Scotia, I guess, has been known for a lot of sinkholes over the years. And the sinkhole happens when rock deep underneath the surface, the ground, eventually gets eroded away by water, groundwater running through there. Over the years, it erodes it, and then the rock dissolves and washes away with the water, and then there's a void underneath the ground, and eventually the void caves in, and whatever's at the top comes down. And so that's how sinkholes are formed, and like I said, Nova Scotia has a lot of them. So we could theorize about that, but we'll talk about the theories in another podcast. But it could be possible that this Oak Island, whoever put whatever they did down there, maybe it was already somewhat of a sinkhole, and that's when they found this. They thought, well, that's a good place to hide something. We just got to dig it out a little further.
That's right.
So now, what are
Well, now you're going to be talking, I think, about, this is 100 years after the Civil War and after Lincoln was shot, and also 100 years after the collapse of the money pit. And we're going to be talking about some more recent discoveries since 1965.
Yes. Well, that's when Dan Blankenship started. He started to try to figure out what is that Oak Island, and he dug out in 1966. Then he dug out more of the original shaft that was found by Bob Dunfield in 65. It turned out that the shaft did go way beyond the 45 feet that Bob Dunfield found. Blankenship found. He found a hand-wrought nail and a washer at 60 feet. And at 90 feet, he met a layer of rocks and stagnant water. Now, he assumed that was part of the Southwater Tunnel, but he couldn't explore further because the shaft couldn't be stopped from caving in. Then in 1967, they were working at the drains on Smith's Cove, and underneath one of the drains, they found a pair of wrought iron scissors. They were later determined that the scissors were Spanish-American, probably from Mexico, and they were up to 300 years old. Now, it's like somebody that was working on this thing got a pair of scissors from possibly Mexico. Well, they were made in Mexico, most likely, but they just happened to leave them underneath when they were building. Building the drains in the Smith's Cove. That's kind of interesting.
It's very interesting.
Wonder how long that guy was walking around saying, "Where are my scissors? I left him right here. I don't know what he probably. But anyway, so
yes.
So then they found out some more about in 1977 when the Triton Alliance, this is a group that was formed by Blankenship, was continuing the search while Triton was building a new cofferdam around that Smith's Cove to try what everybody else was trying, to try to get the water out of it so they could figure out what was going on there. They discovered the remains of what appeared to be the original builder's cofferdam. The findings included logs that were 2 feet thick and up to 65 feet long. They were marked every 4 feet with Roman numerals carved in them, and they contained wooden pins, or some of them had nails, I guess, too. So but they did carbon date that wood back then dated back to that the wood was 250 years old. So and then at the western end of the island, they found several items. There were two wooden structures along with wrought iron nails and some metal straps that were found on the western beach. 9 feet below the beach, a pair of leather shoes were unearthed. And I don't know, I can't find out any more information on what kind of leather shoes or when they think they were from, but that's just kind of an interesting little fact.
You know, as you're talking about this and thinking about this island, it kind of makes me want to go there just to look at it and to walk around. If I don't know if you're able to, but it, after talking about all these searches and over the years, it just to be able to see it in person and just to visualize what actually it looks like in person would be intriguing. And I know you were talking, John, about going there, and you're going to be close to the area even in the near future, so I hope you will be able to get over to that area.
We'll be vacationing not far from there, but I don't know if I want to, if I'm going to have the time to take away from the family for that. I don't know, but that would be nice. But I would suggest if anybody does go there to just be very careful where they're walking, because they have put so many shafts around that,
correct.
I just want to watch where you're walking.
And I suppose it would be somewhat difficult to convince members of your family to drive 800 miles round trip to see the island. They probably would have more interesting or more enjoyable things, at least from their standpoint, to do. And so I can see why you might not get there. But it would be a nice thought. Now we're going to be talking about an important borehole. It's called Borehole 10X. And I just wanted to mention that Dan Blankenship, he's still alive today. And his son, Dave, who's been on the island, I believe, since 1976. So he's been there a long time, too. And Dave is really convinced that something important is there. And he's especially convinced about the importance of Borehole 10X, which is a 237-foot tube of steel. That's kind of impressive. Steel, this is pretty strong stuff. So, and this is sunk 180 feet northeast of the Money Pit. Now, during the digging, several apparently artificial cavities were found down to 230 feet. Now, we get into something a little bit intriguing. A camera was lowered down to a bedrock cavity at 230 feet. And something was visualized on that camera that was kind of startling. At first, a severed hand could be seen floating in the water. Later, three probably treasure chests and some tools were also visualized. And apparently a human body was detected. Now, after they saw these startling images, they decided to send some divers down to look more closely in person. But apparently strong currents and poor visibility down there made it impossible to see anything. Just the camera that had been lowered that allowed them to see these images. Now, soon after this, the hole itself collapsed and it has not been reopened. But Dan Blankenship, in no uncertain words, was sure he saw a severed hand. There was no doubt in his mind.
Well, I believe he was quoted as saying that he saw a hand. He's not saying it's severed. Not necessarily a severed hand, but he saw a hand, no doubt about it. So, I don't know. I take that to mean that he saw a hand. It may have been sticking out of the side of the mud, of the side of the the dirt down there or something. But he did definitely see a hand, he said.
Yeah, and that would wake me up.
Oh, yes.
But anyway, the search is still going on today, and I know that there was a recent television series about this, correct, John?
Yes, the
History Channel.
Yes, it was on the History Channel. It's called The Curse of Oak Island. It debuted in January of 2014, and there were five episodes. There were only five episodes, and they were showing two brothers, Rick and Marty Lagina, from northern Michigan. At least that's where they grew up, in Kingsford, Michigan, which is just over the border from Wisconsin. Oddly enough, it's in upper Michigan. And they, now Rick read the article that was in the Reader's Digest right around probably the same time that I read the article that was in the Weekly Reader. And he became obsessed with it ever since then, really obsessed with it. And his brother, Marty.
I guess more so than you, John, apparently,
well,
because he's actually sticking some money in it, but
that's the difference between Rick and me, is that Rick was able to convince his brother Marty to fund the excursion to Oak Island and spending millions of dollars to try to figure out what's down there. I don't think I could have convinced my brother to do the same. I didn't even try, so. But anyway, so that's where they are.
Still home.
Yes, but the television series, of course, I loved it because I after all these years now to get an update and see and to actually see the video of people there working, I enjoyed watching it. And they didn't, through the whole TV series, they, showed all their little ups and downs, and they showed Dave Blankenship there with him and Daniel Blankenship. But towards the end, the last episode, they did find, they did make a find. Now, there was one of the other episodes, they had a man that came to see them, and he gave his, okay, here we are. He's a Norwegian writer and filmmaker by the name of Peter Odmundsen, and he came there to give his pitch on what he thinks is down there. Now we'll get into that. We'll do a separate podcast on the theories, but it is very interesting. And on the final episode of the show, they made a discovery of a coin, and it is a, and they had it checked, and it is a Spanish coin, from, they think, the 16th century or 17th century, somewhere around in there. And it was a copper coin, so it was in, they believe, the 1600s. It's called the Spanish Maravedi coin, but being in the 1600s, it predates the whole Oak Island pit by a good 150 up to 200 years. So that is interesting. They did make some sort of discovery, and they are planning to push on. So I'm sure they'll have a season two, and I'm just going to guess that it'll come on in January. They're probably there as we're talking right now in the summer of 2014. They're probably there right now working before it gets too cold.
That's what I would be doing if I were them. So that pretty much summarizes what we know about the searches for the money in the money pit, or the treasure in the pit.
Yeah, so thanks for joining us today, and please check for our episode on the theories, because there are several theories and they get a little involved, so just wanted to do that separately. So we hope you enjoyed this one, and we look forward to listening to the next one.
Okay, well, goodbye, John.
Bye.